This is the Cider Guide Podcast. I'm your host, Eric West. Each week, I sit down to chat with a personality from the wide world of cider. No boring theme music, no annoying advertisements, just engaging conversation with interesting guests. Past episodes are always available at ciderguide.com/podcast and feature such luminaries as Tom Oliver of Oliver Cider and Perry, Nicole Bond of Farnham Hill Ciders, and author, photographer, and all-around cider enthusiast Bill Bradshaw. Mike Beck of Uncle John's Cider Mill in St. John's, Michigan, joins me for episode 4. Not only does Mike oversee a huge seasonal retail operation at Uncle John's, he also happens to make some of the best cider, fortified cider, and apple-based spirits in the country. And did I mention that he's a founding board member of the Great Lakes Cider and Perry Association and president of the board of the United States Association of Cider Makers? Mike and I chat about why Michigan is such a great place to make hard cider, how Uncle John's has survived while other orchards have languished, his diverse canned and bottled product lineup, his past and present efforts to further the interests of the cider industry, and much, much more. Here's my conversation with Mike Beck. Joining me today is Mike Beck of Uncle John's Cider Mill in St. John's, Michigan. Mike, I know you're a busy guy. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, no problem. My pleasure, Eric.
Awesome. Well, first thing, I wanted to congratulate you on your recent award at the Royal Bath and West Show in Somerset, very highly commended for your russets. Is this the second or third year in a row that you've won an award there?
Third year in a row, actually, yes.
Third year, excellent. So I wanted to start off with this. I'm always kind of curious about sort of where people are in the world and what makes their region kind of a special place for making cider. So could you talk a little bit about Michigan and maybe sort of your own orchard and what makes it kind of a special place to be making cider?
Oh, you are already starting out with my favorite thing to talk about.
Awesome. So go for it.
Well, I'm an industry guy. I've spent many years on the board, the certain various boards, growing boards of the apple programs around in this state. And one thing I've found out that Michigan is the variety state. There's more varieties planted in a commercial aspect here in Michigan than any other state in the union. So we have lots of things in the ground in pretty good quantity. Semi-loads of wine sap, semi-loads of winter banana, semi-loads of Rhode Island Greening, semi-loads of Northern Spy, semi-loads of Jonathan's, Macintosh, Cortland, Empires, all the Mac varieties. Just as a standard, we have a greater depth of apples to choose from as far as at a reasonable price to make ciders from.
Did that make it easier to kind of enter the hard cider market because you had access to all these kind of historic heirloom varieties that were once used for producing hard cider?
Well, certainly that, but a six-figure federal grant also helped a lot.
As far as starting the hard cider production?
Correct, yeah.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is that I know all over the country that orchards have kind of disappeared over the generations. What was it that allowed Uncle John's to survive? Because I know that there must have been, at some point, a much greater number of orchards in Michigan. How is Uncle John's still around and still being successful?
For a long time, since the 70s, we've relied more on being a retail farm operation. Back in the 70s, the apple market took a real dive, and we're commercial apple growers. Back then, we were probably 200-acre growers, and we pared back down to about 80 in the 70s and became retail-focused. And we started by making fresh juice back then, back in the 70s, pardon me, and adding things like donuts. Cider and donuts is a very popular thing here in Michigan, fresh cider and donuts. So we've been practically a retail farm stand for the last 40 years and growing our orchard bigger now since then, just to handle the things like the fresh cider and hard cider market. And just this last year, we're now starting to actually produce more cider than fresh juice for our business. And we make a fairly significant amount of fresh juice for fall sales.
I know from my visits there that you have a very kind of diversified operation there. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like there in the fall? Because it seems like Uncle John's is kind of like a sort of a legendary institution there. I know from my visit there were thousands of people there. Can you talk a little bit about that experience of what people get when they come out to Uncle John's in the fall?
Oh, sure. It's, you know, practically like a mini version of a Disney World. Lots of themed areas. You know, you can watch us make fresh cider. You can go to our bakery and get donuts and pies and other baked goods that we make here. We have a confectionery where we're making fudge and caramel apples and candied apples. We have all sorts of on-farm fun. Come pick a pumpkin, a fruit fling where you can buy a bag of apples and shoot it at Target's wagon rides. We have a train. We have a gemstone mining. We have the inflatable parks for kids, corn maze, a nature walk. And there might be some, you can obviously taste hard ciders as well.
Right. So it sounds like you kind of have a built-in audience when you start the hard cider for people who are already interested in all the other things you're doing. And it's just another sort of aspect of the entertainment.
Yes. And when we started the hard cider business, our intent was to never sell it beyond the farm gate because I knew we could sell about 10,000 cases of ciders here just in the retail operation. I mean, there are certain days where we have 15,000, 16,000, 17,000 people here in a day. So the audience is here, absolutely. If they're willing to wait in line sometimes it's a 45-minute wait just to get up to taste the cider.
Yeah, it is a pretty amazing experience. So if anyone wants to go and experience what it's like to what a fall weekend in Michigan's like, I definitely recommend a visit to Uncle John's. Let's talk a little bit about your cider. So
sure.
I know that you were one of the first cider makers in the U.S. to can. Can you talk a little bit about your canned cider lineup and how that came about?
Well, once again, that was another federal grant to what they call a value-added grant to try new innovative ways to market value-added products. It's partly spurred on by earning a federal grant, writing a good enough grant, and that kind of got us off the fence. We would have been in it earlier if we didn't wait for the grant, but it still got us in the game pretty early. But it's really a fantastic way to package cider. The aluminum seems to be so much easier to work with than glass, so much less safety concerns as far as the production end of it, spatial concerns. It's really fantastic, and the equipment is fairly easy to operate, as easy as any bottling lines that I've used in the past anyway.
So you're using 16-ounce cans and packaging them in a 4-pack, is that right?
That's right.
And you have the flagship apple, and you have other flavors in the cans as well now?
Yeah, we put our what we call our seasonals, which are just our standard cider, then adjunct with some sort of fruit juice or spice. And then right now we only have 5. Who knows, the list may expand.
Right. What do those retail for, a 4-pack of the cans?
Usually around $11 to $12 at the retail shop.
And those are available throughout Michigan, or your part of Michigan? How far are those being distributed?
At least through all of lower Michigan, upper Michigan coming real soon, and then Chicago and the northern in the suburbs around as of right now.
Let's talk a little bit about your bottled lineup, because they're the ones that I've always been super impressed with. Let's start with the American 150, because you talked about how Michigan has all these different varieties already in the ground. Can you talk a little bit about how the American 150 came about and what its kind of flavor profile is like?
Well, sure. You know, most of those on the list there's lots of them. And then there's two of them, Grimes Gold and Baldwin. Those are a little bit harder to find, but I can get about, practically a semi-load of each in a season, which isn't a lot, but isn't a small amount either. 92 bins times 18 bushels. I forget. I don't know how many thousands of pounds that is, but it's a lot. So we can get about that much of those two, and Rhode Island Greening, Wine Saps, Northern Spies, Winter Banana. My goodness, I could bury myself in them. Four of the six on there, there's practically anyone else could have, you know, the same blend. So I don't want to, they're not, they're, to me, they're still special. It's just we have a lot of those. So right. It's one of the few that I can actually make a fair bit of in a season. It's, as far as like the method on it, I kind of put a little bit of an old world spin on it, you know, a little bit of barrel and some of it, but a lot of it's still stainless aged. It's only got a slight little prickle to it as far as any carbonation. It's still bottled in a still wine format, lightly. The first vintage was completely bone dry, but that was a little too austere. So I just added a tiny amount of sugar this last bout.
I find that it's excellent both ways. So it's definitely one of my favorites from your lineup. One of the things that I think people who are just getting into cider, they maybe have this impression that more ciders are kind of estate bottled. But it sounds like from what you're saying is that in order to get some of these varieties that you want to use in your cider, you kind of have to source them from other places. It sounds like that's definitely true for the American 150. Is that true of your other bottled ciders as well?
Mostly, the American 150 is a blend of, I'd say, three farms, if you want to get right down to it. My farm,
okay.
A guy right off the Lake Michigan, and a guy over what we call the Ridge, which is north of Grand Rapids. And then the others are a blend of, outside of Perry, the others are a blend of my farm and the Wards, Tim and Cindy Ward over at Eastman Orchards in Wheeler, Michigan. So right now they're limited to kind of like a my farm and maybe one or two other guys.
Do you want to talk about the Russet next? You're the Bath and West winner?
Sure. And yeah, that's, like I said, a blend of probably about a third of mine and two thirds of it comes from the Eastman Orchard. And, you know, mine is mostly, I only have golden russet in the ground, but they have probably 40 different kinds of russet in the ground, and I love them all. They're all great. Some are real, there's a huge range of flavor profiles in russets, too, like a knobby russet, so earthy. And then there's others that are just so tropical fruit tasting. I love the ranges of flavors that you get with russets.
For those who aren't familiar with russeting, can you kind of describe what russeting is on an apple?
It's, you know, the best I compare it to is like potato skin, but that's where, you know, the apple feels very rough skinned and something even like a pear, like a Bosch pear or something. So they may not look so appealing, but man, typically every one of them is a great tasting apple.
Golden russet has pretty high alcohol potential. Is that true of the other russets as well?
I'd say I'd say it varies over the board. I know probably the overall ending bricks with such a huge different variety load ends up being around 16 bricks and change. Where my average one for the standard canned cider would be around 14 bricks.
So you also make a cider from Baldwin apples, and I know that's a really popular one. You want to talk about the Baldwin?
Yep, I get those from a gentleman named Russ here over in Oceana County, that's right close to the lake. It's a very old orchard. Those are all on old standard trees. I was inspired by that, quite honestly, West County ciders out in Massachusetts. I had always wondered if there was any varieties out there that are kind of worthy of being, you know, made into variety ciders. Because, most of what we have here in America, I would say it's sketchy. And bald, right. But their Baldwin was like, I had it and was like, well, this is pretty dynamic for one apple. So I started playing with it. You know, at times Baldwin can be, hey, this is interesting to very, very cool.
Right.
And, is it as dynamic as some of the European varietals? Absolutely not. No, but it's in its own right. It's a pretty cool apple.
And so you do have the melded, right? That does use some of the European apple varieties.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. European, English and French ones, primarily or mostly, but, you know, there's a few actually, one or two Polish apples that actually end up in that blend too.
Another fan favorite is the rosé. Can you talk a little bit about that one, the red-hued cider?
Yeah, that's a real special one. We were able to really get a lot of production this last year over there, and that's actually exclusively from our friends over in Eastman Orchards. You know, there's one apple that they have a fair bit of. I can't even begin to pronounce it. I mean, you've seen the label.
I have, the one that starts with an N.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to try it, you go ahead. But that's really Wheeler over in Wheeler. They call it Knives Why.
Okay.
It's a shortened name, but it's definitely the Cabernet Sauvignon of red flesh varieties. And it's a fairly big apple. You cut it through and through, and it's deep red to the core, even inside the core. It's a really big, bold apple. If you can eat a whole one, for one, their size, it's pretty burnt darn big, but they're quite tannic. That's the one that really makes the red hue in the cider. But the Albert Edder ones, they're much fruitier. There's a lot of those that they have that are basically mostly the Albert Edder kind of bread varieties. A lot of those are pink-hued in the middle. Lots of nice, bright acids. Really cool, sugary fun.
So are these varieties like Pink Pearl?
Yeah, exactly. Pink Pearl,
okay.
And Thompson's Pink and Cripps Pink. There's so many that I...
Well, I would love to see that as a trend. I think those rosé ciders could be very popular. Could you talk about sort of the balance between having a great tasting complex cider and getting that red hue? Is that sort of a difficult bargain to make work?
I'm going to be real honest here. It's more of the blending involved here was more of me keeping all the red flesh ones set aside and using every one of them and see what comes out of it.
Right.
So the selection was strictly based on red fleshedness. And there's a couple of crabs in there too, not a terrible amount, but a few that are quite red as well. So as far as I wasn't trying to get anywhere outside of using all the red flesh ones
right.
together.
Well, I think we've talked about most of your ciders, at least if not all of them. Can you talk a little bit about your distilling operations? Because that seems to be something that's that not as many people know about as your ciders.
Yeah, well, it's for one, you know, it's very difficult in this state to sell spirits because it's a control state. So we've used it so far mostly as a way to get fortified apple spirits or apple spirits for fortification and a little bit of sales of spirits through the tasting room. And then a lot of what we've done with has been custom work for other people. When I was venturing, you know, 15 years ago, tramps around Michigan and other parts of the state, looking at wineries and looking at their model, which is, you know, a tasting room to create the brand, essentially, make a fun experience for people. So even though
people can get your ciders in other parts of the state now, they still have to come to Uncle John's to sample the spirits. Is that right?
That's correct. So they've been very popular here. They have a fairly high retail price, but we can still sell, you know, several hundred cases of them through here. And we can make a very good fortified spirit when you're using, you know, some people can only get grape neutral spirits or some sort of neutral spirit for fortification. When you're using your own spirit, apple spirit, for fortification of making pomos, I think you can really step it up a notch and make a first-class pomo that way.
Yeah, so, I think your dessert wine, the apple dessert wine, it's fantastic. It's very sort of a clean, it's not like your sort of Normandy style, but it's a very clean, fortified pomo type, and I think it's great.
Yeah. And so, quite honestly, when I was traps around the state looking at these places, Michigan has several places that have these beautiful copper and brass stills. Quite frankly, I said I want one of those. That was as big a push for anything. So when we got our license, we decided to get licensed as a distillery as well. We started out very modestly, and we never even sold a spirit until we had some spirits aged at least 4 years that we could blend with maybe some two-year-old spirit. So we waited at least 4 years before we even sold any kind of spirit itself. We were selling dessert wine or Pomot well before then, but we wanted to wait till we had a really nice product before we even released the brandy.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, and I can't even pronounce eau de vie or eau de vie.
Right.
I don't know how to say it, so how can I sell it? You can do, I mean, that you can sell quick and early and all that, but and now we make a vodka from apples as well, which is probably one of the smoothest vodkas you can get, actually. It's not a neutral vodka, but it's very easy to drink.
Yeah, I think I've had some of that. It is very smooth. I'm not much of a vodka person, but it's something that I think everyone should try. Well, I know that you wear a lot of different hats. Do you mind talking a little bit about USACM and your role with sort of the National Cider Association?
Sure. Yeah.
So can you maybe just give us a brief history, like when was the organization founded? Why was it founded? And sort of what are the current operations of the association?
It's got a fairly old start. Actually, people started getting together to talk about the industry back at a Cider Days event, maybe going on 8 years ago now. I can't remember. Maybe.
And this is in Franklin County, Cider Days in Massachusetts?
Correct. And okay. Talking about how we have industry issues, maybe it was 7 years ago. I can't quite remember. But, we recognized that we all had other hurdles besides marketing. Because no one could agree on anything about marketing, but there's the other things. Sure, there's a lot of things we could agree on. So, and we started getting together out in places like Portland, Oregon, and as more people got in business and, was put on together on a shoestring by people like Ben Watson or James Cohen or us in having some sort of impromptu meeting during one of the Great Lakes events or whatever. So, it's got a little bit of a history behind it, but it's really only about 2 years ago it became official. I'm in my second term, official organization.
Okay, so this probably would have been in February of 2013, I guess, maybe?
Right.
That it was formed?
Right. You're right. I do believe.
So a board was elected, and you, I guess, were appointed as president.
Correct.
What have you and the board done so far to kind of further the cause of cider in the U.S.?
Well, our main focus for developing this group was our legislative issues that we have out there. So that's where the board grew from. And that's been what we've been trying to tackle so far beyond trying to put on a great conference. And last year, we really did have a great conference. There was a lot of really good material that I went away with, very excited about.
And this is the CiderCon event that's held in Chicago.
Correct.
Okay.
So a lot of great educational material, a lot of great momentum from the public as well. Happens out there with the Cider Summit that's put on out there on Navy Pier.
Sure.
And so there's. A tremendous amount of industry, I'm trying to think of a word here, coming together and sharing ideas, and there's a great also pull from the public about cider. They're very, the bars and restaurants are all about it there. The people come out to the events and support them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of great momentum that happens from SaterCon. So two main goals is the legislative issue and putting on a great event. As we grow as an organization, we hope to do more.
Could you talk a little bit more about the legislative issues? Because I know that with you being in the trade, you're very aware of those. But for your kind of average consumer, like what sort of legislative hurdles is cider facing right now?
In simple terms, we'll call it a gas tax. And by gas, I mean CO2. If a cider ends up with over a certain threshold, the tax goes from a very reasonable amount to a very unreasonable amount. And when I say that, it goes from, in gallons, from 17 cents for the average small producer anyway, to $3.30. Well, actually, for the average small producer, $2.90. So that's a big swing in federal tax. So that is the biggest scope of the legislation, is trying to get a tax rate that is actually in line with the European Union standard. Same with the ABV on the product. We are looking to go for a slightly higher alcohol product, and the inclusion of pears to be in the same tax definition.
So right now it seems like that the 7% threshold is kind of limiting cider makers and what sort of products they can put out on the market. You're saying that the idea is to try and increase that 7%?
Yes, to 8.5.
Okay, and so increase the alcohol a little bit, stop the sort of punitive taxation for the carbonation, and then kind of allow the use of pears, which were, you know, historically used as well as apples, to make cider. Is that a good summary?
Correct. Yep, great summary.
Okay. CiderCon for next year in 2015 is also slated to be in Chicago. Is that right?
Yep, at the Swiss Hotel. Very nice hotel. A great rate, too. We secured a rate of around, I think, $119 a night for the event. So a great deal on a fantastic hotel. It's very close to Navy Pier, which where the Cider Summit event is at. So very close to all events. I know if you go to the USACM website, you can, I do believe, register and I think even reserve rooms.
Right. And so this is, even though it is an industry event, it is something that people who are maybe in the planning stages of starting a cidery, or even just, you know, huge enthusiasts, is it something that they can attend as well?
Absolutely. And I would say at least 15% of last year's attendees were people that did not have licenses yet.
So. And so there's a lot of workshops, educational opportunities, just kind of informal networking.
I have not seen any lineups put together, the last 2 years there's been programs designed for the very small, as well as educational programs for the large producers too.
Okay.
So a great, and a lot of those are put on by people in the industry. So you're getting practical experience from people that are actually doing it. But also we bring in academia too to talk about the finances that are part of it or other aspects of it, and other professionals.
So I think if you'd like to learn more, I believe the website is ciderassociation.org, and you can also find information about the Cider Conference at that website. Well, Mike, one last thing before I let you go. I know that you're a busy guy. You've been involved with the Great Lakes Cider and Perry Association probably since its inception. Can you talk about the two big events that the GLCPA puts on each year?
Sure. Well, the biggie is the competition.
The Great Lakes International Cider and Perry Competition, or GLENCAP as we call it.
Right. Started out fairly small competition, grown now to be a very large competition, somewhere between 500 and 600 samples. Now I know you have a better gauge on the number, but
I think it's 531 this year.
531. Nice.
Yeah.
Which is as big as any around, I'd say. We started fairly modestly, very much pushed by the our initial director, Rex Halfpenny, and he puts on a lot of beer competitions throughout the country and even other places throughout the world. And he helped us through early challenges, and we're working with BJCP style guidelines, which are the only style guidelines for cider judging that exist. So,
right, and the authors of those guidelines are often with us to judge at the competition. So,
correct, yes, people like Big Don and Charles McGonigal and Gary Audi, you know, people that are know and care about cider, you know.
Right.
So, so they match pretty well what's going on in the cider industry. Although there's you know, new things happening in the cider industry all the time, so it's hard to keep up. But so, you know, I think it's another opportunity, though, that we try to bring in as many industry professionals as we can to also make it a learning experience. So we've always had the session before where we go through the styles of ciders that are out there and taste examples of them. We also do some sensory training where we learn about faults and other things that can happen to cider. So we try to treat it as much as an educational opportunity as a competition as well.
Yeah, and I think the sensory analysis and the sort of the educational seminar, that's the highlight of the weekend for many people. I know that many people walk away from that thinking just, wow, like I just learned so much about cider. So for those of you out there, keep your eye out for announcements about the 2015 Glen Cap. We would love to see some people out there. And then you have an event in the fall, right, at Uncle John's?
Yep, we have the Great Lakes Cider and Perry Festival, an event that I put on here for anyone from throughout the country can send cider, and I hope people listening, you know, send cider. We'll find someone to pour it for you and present it in a nice manner. But we bring in mostly Michigan trade professionals, but a few others from around the Great Lakes have shown up. People like Edon Call from Original Sin, and gosh, people from outside the region. Mount Hardy's been here before, and
from Maiden Rock,
Wisconsin. Yeah. Charles McGonigal, and Gary brings up ciders from Indiana. So we have you know, trade professionals that come up, but we'll if you just send the ciders, we'll get them out, get them iced down, we'll get some volunteers to pour them. The volunteers that come and the trade professionals that come afterwards, we also have a nice real nice dinner. But yeah, just a nice casual event. Since we're a board that's a non-profit board, we don't have a ton of money to advertise, so it's a fairly
right.
It's not a huge event, you know, a little less than 1,000 people usually show up for it. So it doesn't draw those huge, huge numbers like some events. But
it sounds like a fantastic variety of ciders that are being poured there.
Yes, typically well over 100 different ciders you can try. So.
And it looks like from visiting GreatLakesCider.com, it looks like this year's event is on September 6th. Well, Mike, thanks for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope we meet in person again sometime soon.
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Take care.
All right, take care. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to talk with Mike, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. To learn more about Uncle John's, visit ujcidermill.com for the retail operation and ujhardcider.com for the cider, perry, and spirits. To learn more about the United States Association of Cider Makers and their annual cider conference, visit ciderassociation.org and ciderconference.com. And to learn more about the Great Lakes Cider and Perry Association and their events, visit greatlakescider.com. I hope you've enjoyed this fourth episode of the Cider Guide podcast. Many listeners have shared with me that they've enjoyed reading transcripts of these interviews, but unfortunately I'm not always able to post the transcript when each episode airs. If you'd like to help me with the transcribing, even if it's for only part of an episode, I'd greatly appreciate your assistance. I'm at CiderGuide on Twitter, or you can email me directly at eric@ciderguide.com. That's eric@ciderguide.com. Thanks for listening. If you like what you're hearing, please consider rating the podcast on iTunes or leaving a comment on the episode page at ciderguide.com/podcast. I appreciate your support, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another episode of the Cider Guide podcast.